And I want to remind people, this is blah, blah, blah. Talk radio, 231-8187 is the number to call. But we're going to do a lot of guesting and talking first. And Cheney!
Yeah, he shot a guy.
We knew he was out of control. But it's just a hunting accident, dude. It can happen to anybody.
Well, now, apparently Cheney didn't do anything wrong at all. But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that in a minute. But you got Halliburton?
Yeah, we got Halliburton.
Iraq?
Talking with Ron first?
Why don't you start with your stuff, and then we'll jump to Ron, and then we'll... We don't rehearse, folks. This is real life.
I don't know how many of you out there are aware of this, but there are certain corporations who are making a lot of money.
No!
The Iraq. It's true.
Yeah, the one thing I know about this war is that some people are getting rich, but that's true of all wars.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a reporter named Juliet McCour in the New York Times who wrote
New York Times, liberal publication.
A wonderful profile about soldiers who've been wounded in Iraq.
Yeah, actually it was good, Pete.
On Sunday in the Times. Also in the Times on Sunday, a short recap of profits from the Iraq War.
Wait, back up. Profits. Profiteering?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've got a small list here of the six top defense contractors and the percentages by which their profits have grown since 2004.
So these are people who are involved in this war who mm-hmm. made some money. Nothing outrageous, though.
Well, just listen. Boeing, this is since 2004. Boeing's profits have grown by 37.4%.
Oh.
Lockheed Martin's by 44.2%.
Ooh.
General Dynamics by 19.1%. Mm-hmm. Northrop Grumman by 29.2%. Raytheon by 108.9%. This is since 2004.
Okay.
And Halliburton, 292.9%.
Now, why didn't I buy that? The real question is, why aren't we holding those stocks?
I don't know, Joe. I can't answer that.
Bad politics.
But this is just since 2004. I'm sure there's a number of business people in a number of industries who would kill to have profit growths like that. And I guess these guys just went ahead and killed.
Right. Hey, right. You know, it's legal. It's all perfectly legal. You know, there's been a lot of literature recently pointing out that the way in which this whole system works since, in fact, there's a movie. I didn't bring the thing. At the Cinema 21, there's this movie which everyone should see.
In Their Words? Is that what it's called? In Their Words?
No.
What's that called? I don't know what you're talking about.
Somebody better call us and tell us. I forgot my thing about it. But it's this great movie about the whole military-industrial complex. And Eisenhower, in 1960, President Eisenhower, Republican, I want to point out, conservative guy, warned against the military-industrial. The original speech was military-industrial congressional complex. They took the words congressional out of his speech. But he warned that this situation we're in now could overtake democracy in America, that it could destroy our society in many, many ways. 1960, while he was president of the United States, long time ago. And in fact, this is what's happened. For example, B-2 bombers. They're made, all the parts are made everywhere so that every state has a stake in defense contracts. And every congressperson fears to cut the defense budget because that'll mean jobs in their states. It's a hookup of the worst sort. And it makes it very hard to get out of it.
Now, Eisenhower, he knows from military, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, but he was dead. He's dead.
Right.
Natural death. I want to add. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right, let's move on. Go ahead.
Well, all right. So what is your point? You're complaining that these defense contractors made too much money.
Well, we're capitalists, Joe. We can't make too much money.
Why do you hate America so?
No, what I'm complaining is that that these people are seeing an obscene increase in the level of profit they're raking in. And they're doing it in a war that's illegitimate. They're doing it at the cost of American and Iraqi blood. And they're doing it in a way that runs totally counter to the established rules of ethics in the marketplace. There's $9 billion plus that's gone completely missing.
I like that. I saw the blocks on CBS on the CBS 60 Minutes. I saw the blocks of money, these $100,000 blocks of money that they toss around.
Yeah. $100 million.
Well, the blocks are each $100,000.
Oh.
They're wrapped in cellophane or shrink-wrapped, I think, actually. They're very nice. I would like some of those. I mean, I think it would be really cool to have, like, a coffee table made out of blocks of money.
Sure, or you could heat your house.
You could heat your house.
Yeah.
All right, anyway. So what we have a guest in studio, and I want to welcome Ron Buell. I have to say, in the interest of fairness, that I once worked for Ron when he was running Willamette Week. I was a reporter for his publication, and we exposed a bunch of stuff.
We were writing a lot about the shootings by the police. Those don't seem to have stopped altogether, do they, Joe?
No, they haven't gone away. But, you know, the police...
On the other hand, your article about Trojan was, I think, instrumental in making some things happen there, along with Lloyd Marbette and Greg Cifori and their great work. But that was a nice time. We had a good time back in those days.
The work I was actually most proud of was the stuff that Bev Walton and I did about the sterilization of the unintelligent by the state.
Yes, great article.
Well, we uncovered the fact that people were dying from these operations, and they were essentially being done on women because it was messy when they had their menses. So they were just sterilizing them and neutering them, essentially. And then some would die because the operations were botched. And these, of course, people couldn't give an informed permission. So that stopped. We actually stopped that.
Hmm.
Anyway, accomplishments, small accomplishments. But, Ron, you're not here about that. And you're no longer running Willamette Week. What are you doing?
I have a small Visa debit card business that's aimed at the unbanked segment of our society. Seems that 40% of the American workforce doesn't have a checking account or any plastic of any kind, a credit card or a debit card. And these folks are getting ripped off by the payday loan companies. And they don't have checking accounts because of the $30 overdraft fees. And so it's in our two-tier economy today, it's a great place to be working with a bottom tier.
And this gives people a way to organize their
finances and manage their money and budget. So it's a business with social value if you believe in such things.
I do. Well, we do. Because we're so well paid to do it. Anyway, the Portland Tribune this last Friday carried a big headline. By the way, this story, you will not hear this story in the Oregonian, because the Oregonian's fundamental position is what you don't know can't hurt the Oregonian. This story, on the other hand, is in the Portland Tribune, and on Friday there's a big story. Transit mall plan draws mix of foes, and you were one of these foes, Ron, but I want people to picture this, because you may not know what's going on out there. There's going to be a new light rail line that's going to run from Union Station up 5th and 6th, all the way to Portland State, and it's going to be part of a vast circle of connection going all the way out to, eventually, I guess, Oregon City or that region. And it's a good plan, fundamentally. There are some real problems about it that we'll talk about, though, some very real problems. Now, picture this, though. A few years hence, 2 years from now, first of all, 2 years of total chaos on 5th and 6th. Businesses closing, you know, things getting really rotten. Buses on 3rd and 4th, 11th and 12th, 10th and 11th. You know, picture this, buses going up, huge numbers of buses going up various streets. Then, at the end of that, you have a transit mall that consists of, I want to say planes, trains, and automobiles, but there's no planes. That's everything else, though. There's trains, there's buses, there's cars, weaving the trains on tracks, weaving from one side of the street to the other, automobiles trying to negotiate that, buses trying to negotiate that, a incredibly complex system that's actually going to require a special control tower, or whatever they call it, control center.
Command center.
Command center to operate it, and about 50, some say 80 of the buses that regularly would be there during the rush hours will actually have to be on 3rd and 4th or 10th and 11th.
Or Columbia and Jefferson.
Or Columbia and Jefferson. So, so this is a plan that you probably out there didn't know much about because it hasn't been very well covered. And even though there have been public hearings, the mysterious disappearance of 50 to 80 buses per rush hour has never been discussed. But, Ron, I want you to describe what's going on and what you guys are proposing and so on.
Well, this is a plan that TriMet has been pushing forward since back in 2002. And in this plan, there's some good things about it. Downtown remains the hub for light rail and buses, and we get to refurbish our 30-year-old transit mall. And Now, local businesses put up $12 million of their own money, the owners of property on the mall, to redo the mall. But the current serpentine design in which the buses and the light rail train weave back and forth, going over to the sideline and out to the center of the street, much as the buses do today on the mall. They're out in the middle, and then they go past a bunch of buses that are sitting there picking up passengers, and then they come into the curb at their stop. But when you add the light rail to this, what happens is that the buses have to slow down because the light rail does not accelerate as fast as the bus, and it doesn't stop as fast. It's got to go slower. And so you really got two lanes because the TriMet plan calls for the left-hand lane of the what will be a three-lane bus mall all the way. It's not that way now, but it will be.
So the sidewalks get smaller.
In three locations they do, yes, between Yamhill and Taylor, between Washington and Stark, and between Burnside and Ash. But the point is that here you've got the automobiles having a whole lane of their own. There are no parking for the automobiles, so they're kind of going around the block. And why people think that is going to help business to have that auto lane during peak hours on the mall, so that you have to make these buses and the trains use only two lanes of the three lanes and weave back and forth across one another as they go to the curb and out into the center. It's going to be a little messy, and that's why TriMet has to have this command center, because it's an inherently unsafe design.
Why add cars to the mix? Why not just add the trains if that's what they're after?
Well, the cars are on the mall now, but this through auto lane is the idea of some of the businesses who put up the $12 million in the local improvement district. And so they wanted to see a through auto lane. But the experts who look at these kinds of things, and George Crandall, one of the internationally recognized planners for urban designers was there last night, and he was talking about the fact that if you don't have parking there, even teaser parking, which he calls it, it doesn't do the business any good to have the buses driving by. You can't even really do a good kiss-and-ride operation with the automobile because, hey, there's only one lane, and if somebody stops, then the cars behind them can't go. In theory, at least, they can't go out into the bus and train lane. It would be dangerous. But they are going to be unloading passengers into the bus and train lane from the right, because the passengers get out of the right generally. They don't get out of the left where people are driving. So they're going to enter the street into these two lanes of...
Into the path of the buses and trains.
That's exactly right. And so it's not a very safe operation, but the big point to be made is that it reduces the transit capacity. So, this is a problem because right now, 44% of our commute comes downtown by rail or bus, and 44% comes downtown by a single person in an automobile, and the remaining 12% comes by trolley or walking or carpool or bicycle. Bicycle is 6% or so these days. It's amazing how many people are riding their bus their bike into downtown. So, but the important point is TriMet's been cutting back on the bus service the last six quarters. It's cut back on the bus service, and this is a problem for the transit system, because the bus takes 24% of the riders now, and the rail takes 20%. And the new rail line isn't yet going out to Oregon City or Milwaukee to the south. It's circling around down by Portland State, and they're taking on I-205. They're going to take a light rail out to Clackamas Town Center and then bring it in along the Banfield as the trains from the east are coming in today. So they're justifying the increased volumes on that new leg out I-205 to Clackamas Town Center. And so that's what's justifying the expenditure of this money, is the increased volume that's theoretically going to come from that new leg into downtown. And so they had, in order to get this done, they had to raise the money from the businesses, and that's where they got the $12 million for local match, and it's probably less than 10% of the whole project, but the people who gave that money wanted more their businesses on the mall, and there are a lot of businesses on the mall. Right now, if you count back to 4th and partway and back to Broadway partway, so you're talking about a half block plus 5th and 6th, which is right on the mall, there are 39 retail establishments, including Myron Frank and two blocks of Pioneer Place, which has a lot of different stores in it, 36 restaurants and coffee shops, and 19 bank and financial service businesses, and there's 4 parking garages between 5th and 6th. And as they take the 2 years to construct this new mall, what's going to happen?
2 years?
Yeah, it's going to take 2 full years to construct this weave and to do all the utility work underneath the street, which is complicated by the weave. So we have the idea. It's a kind of a crazy idea, I guess, because it wasn't among the finalists considered by TriMet, but we have the idea that why not separate the light rail and the buses and close the auto lane down during peak hours, keep the autos off the mall during peak hours, and run the light rail down the left side and the 2 lanes of buses down the right side so they can pass one another and they don't mix together. And that would enable you to get light rail down one half and the buses down, I mean, one third, and the buses down the other two thirds during rush hour. And that means that the construction costs would go down, and more importantly, the construction time would go down, because when we built the original mall, 26% of these businesses closed during the time of construction. It's going to be a real mess downtown, and we still have a real downtown still has a real monopoly on Class A office space in the region, and about over a third of it is going to come up for new lease during the 2-year construction period, and downtown's going to be a real mess because they're going to take the buses off and put them on 3rd and 4th during this period of time, and they're taking 120 to 150 parking spaces off of 3rd and 4th in order so the buses can pull over to the curb. And that means the retailers on 3rd and 4th, which there are a lot. There are 53 retail establishments and 45 restaurants and coffee shops, mm-hmm. plus 3 hotels and 9 parking lots and 7 parking garages on 3rd and 4th. And so it's when you take those on-street parking places off, you know, it's going to be a mess to come into downtown for these 2 years. Mm-hmm. And if they could somehow shorten that, which they could if they'd move the transit over to the left lane and kind of half the street and do the construction of the light rail and the intersections and the utilities underneath the street all on the left side and kind of leave the right side except for the intersections as it is, they could significantly cut the construction time.
Well, now, there are several things that obviously come to mind. First of all, it seems to me that long ago they should have acknowledged the reality of the limit of the 2-car trains, the MAX trains, and they should have developed a subway system for the area from Union Station to Portland State and from the river to 10th and 11th. I mean, all up to the freeway, all that should have been, they should have bit the bullet and spent the $1 billion that probably would cost and built that subway system.
Well, if we want to keep downtown, the central city, as the center and the hub of this quickly growing region, then you have to have a high-capacity transit system, or you have to have a lot more people live downtown than live there now. We've got about 20% of the jobs in the region still in the central city. That's a big number. So you still have quite a few people commuting in, but a lot more people live in the burbs and work in the burbs than they did in 1960. You mentioned Eisenhower in 1960. You and I were actually around in Portland in 1960. And the point is that 80% of the retail was then in the downtown core, and today it's fallen to 22% of the retail in the region, and that's because of the shopping malls at Lloyd Center and Clackamas Town Center, Washington Square, and so forth, and because people are living in the burbs and driving to work in the burbs. And
well,
So if we want a healthy central city, you're absolutely right, Joe. Let me just say that. We need to have high-capacity transit, and you have to separate the grade. Now, it doesn't have to be a subway. Those of us who have visited Vancouver, B.C., see that beautiful L up there. The point is it's grade-separated. Right now, the trains can only be two cars long, as you point out, because they have to stop in a block, and they it takes 23 minutes to get from 18th and Jefferson over to the Lloyd Center on the light rail. 23 minutes to go through downtown Portland. And that means your transit isn't competitive with the automobile because it takes so doggone long through the central city. And as we move this new, slower mall in and take some buses off the mall, TriMet says up to 50, and some people are suggesting it's going to have to be more than that to make the mall work safely. As we do that, it's going to lower the capacity of the system. It's going to be a more confusing, less intuitive bus and rail system, and people won't know where to make their transfers and where to make their stops like they do today. And so it's going to be a real problem for transit. And you're right. To make the central city work as an urban area should, we got to have a subway.
Well, but even short of that, running the trains straight through the mall makes more sense than weaving them, which is what they're proposing, adding buses as it is now, and then adding cars on top of that. It seems insane to me. The fact that buses won't fit in the mall during rush hour and they're going to have to go on 3rd or 4th or some other streets also makes no sense to me. But beyond that, a couple of things I want to make clear. We didn't know we were going to do the show till yesterday. We did call TriMet. We left messages with them. If they call in and identify themselves, we'll jump them on to respond to this because this is the 11th hour. This project is going to be in final form in March, as I understand it, and it's going to be it's been earmarked for fast federal funding, which is good on one hand, but it's pretty quick on another. And I know we do have callers, so let's go to our first caller, 231-8187. Pear, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Pear, you're on the air.
Yeah, you know something? I mean, they call this light rail, but basically it's a glorified streetcar.
Okay.
And, you know, the big mistake with light rail, I like riding light rail. It's really nice. The big mistake was they should have just kept it as a, they should have kept it off the streets entirely, and maybe then it would make a real nice commuter line. You know, you could have longer trains, they go faster. You know, and like what Ron was saying about crossing downtown, I took the train in from Hillsboro one time. Gee whiz, you know, from Hillsboro to Goose Hollow, you know, it goes real fast. You know, you're there in no time at all. As soon as you get on the streets, you just slow down to a crawl. And so that's the big mistake, you know, just having it on the streets in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other surface transportation is going to interfere with any existing surface transportation. Pear, thank you for the call. We got a slight technical problem here with our guests' headphones, so I appreciate the call.
So
yeah,
I'll get it figured out. So we'll chatter without callers right now, we think it's here on this board or something. Anyway, plugging it in works. I'll be doggone. Wow, high-tech invention that. Plugging it in. Okay, so, again, if you're just tuning in, our guest is Ron Buell. This is Talk Radio with Abe and Joe. It's 231-8187. What we're focusing in on today, we've been doing a lot of international stuff, a lot of Bush disasters. We're going to talk about the Transit Mall, which is going to have the serpentine movement of trains, buses, and cars. And it's going to take 2 years to construct it. I mean, people don't even know this, I don't think.
We're not out of Bush disasters, by the way.
More Bush disasters.
Plenty of those still out there for us.
And don't forget the shooting, Cheney, yeah, the killer.
Right, that's right.
Well, he hasn't killed the guy.
No.
He just peppered him with birdshot.
Peppered him with birdshot.
Birdshot, that must hurt. Ooh, I've seen that in movies where they take it out of your butt, birdshot.
I'm confused on a fundamental point here. We're talking about a revamped transit mall where the light rail trains run north-south along the existing malls. Right now they run east-west on what, Yamhill and Morrison?
They'll continue to do that. So the cross-mall alignment for the routes that are doing that will continue to exist.
So we're talking about adding another spur to the light rail system?
Yeah, basically it runs up to Jackson Street in Portland State.
Well, I am confused.
And where would that go?
It circles around and comes back down the other side. So it's just really putting a little spur up to Portland State.
Why?
A loop.
Why?
I think that's a good thing. I think getting them students the ability to get on the light rail train and make their connections work better. That's not bad.
You got the number 8 bus. You got the trolley on 10th and 11th.
Yeah, we'd like to see a system in which the light rail goes south to Milwaukee and then on out to Oregon City.
Oh, so this is a link that eventually will loop around?
Eventually, if they ever get the funding to do it. And this is being justified, as I said, by the connection on I-205 out to Clackamas Town Center that then comes in and comes in the Banfield to the city. And it's a so-called green line, and we'll provide some service for people who want to ride light rail from out in the Clackamas area into the city.
Well, I like the idea. I mean, I like Max. I use it. I like the idea of a line out to Oregon City or even out to the Clackamas Town Center. And I guess the freeway route makes the most sense at this point. But I'm troubled at the point when it all crosses the... already I see a mess with the yellow line not quite connecting easily for people who are moving from one line to another, connecting to the red and blue lines at the
Rose
convention.
Garden.
Yeah, the Rose Garden. Yeah. That's a problem to me.
Yeah, you got to walk like a block.
Well,
from one station to another.
It's more than a block, and some people don't do that. And the other thing that is even more weird to me is, I'm just trying to visualize this. If there are trains coming in and they're going to have to go over to Union Station and then crossing the Steel Bridge, go over to Union Station and then come back, aren't trains going to have to cross each other?
Yeah, the outgoing and the ingoing will, in fact, cross each other just west of the Steel Bridge. And that's a real throughput problem. It's gonna eventually slow down. And this whole system of rail and buses running together on the mall is a problem if a bus has a maintenance problem, and they're going to have to get it off of there pretty quick because it's going to be a mess if there are fires, if there are, when we have the icy weather, there's not much margin for error in this new system of running buses in with a light rail and automobile.
I have a process problem. I just have to say this. I understood that all this was well thought out and that there was a citizen input process. I didn't know that there were going to be buses very possibly on 3rd and 4th or 10th and 11th or whatever, even after this two-year operation of repair and creation. I don't think I understood what was going on, and I guess I just missed the realities of it. Or is it possible the TriMet didn't lay all its cards on the table?
Well, there wasn't a lot of talk about taking 2 years to build the mall, and there wasn't a lot of talk about the taking buses off the mall after construction is completed. And they still haven't told us how they're going to do that exactly. And they're saying different things at different times about what their design is, but they haven't laid one out for people. You know, Joe, these citizen participation processes, they can be managed. So we've been talking about separating the light rail and buses on the mall, putting the light rail on the left and the buses on the right.
Yeah.
And that wasn't one of the final three designs that they looked at.
So it's like when your little kid, it's cold out and you want your little kid to wear a jacket. You don't say, do you want to wear a jacket? You say to the kid, do you want the red jacket or the blue jacket?
That's exactly right. You give them choices, but they're the choices that you pick for them. And
you say TriMet is basically picking the choices.
Well, that's what happened here, and it did it based on the desires of the businesses who wanted to see this auto lane on the mall, and because that's what at peak hours that's what screws up the throughput. And so, you know, it's managing the citizen participation process, and everything these days in Portland has to go through a citizen. Unfortunately, they don't let us citizens participate in deciding whether to go to war in Iraq. But in Portland, we get to participate in all these city and county and regional decisions. And people have gotten pretty good at saying, as you say, you want the red jacket or the blue jacket, and giving choices that are not real choices. And that's kind of what we had in this situation. And I think if you said to Tony Mendoza, who's the head of design for TriMatter, you said to Greg Baldwin and Doug Oblitz, who are very esteemed, smart guys who worked on this design, if you said, oh, well, is this your chosen design? You guys came up with this, huh? And they would say, well, I think those three people would say, well, we were kind of given this and told we had to make it work, and we've done the best job we could at doing that. So it's not the kind of thing where there were real options laid out for people. And I can remember testifying at the city planning commission back in 2003 when they had the hearings, and the room was full, and there were a lot of testimony, and I stood up and said, hey, you're going to increase the conflict between light rail and buses, and between light rail and light rail where they cross at Morrison and Yamhill, and coming across the bridge and so forth, you're going to increase the conflict between buses and people, and between buses and automobiles, and this is just not going to be a very smooth working high capacity downtown transit system. And you know, Fred Hansen sat there and rolled his eyes, and so we get light rail on the mall, which a lot of people think is a mistake, not just yours truly. And so we get it, but really this is the 11th hour, as you point out. They managed the citizen participation process well. I think if you talk to the city commissioners, they will say that there wasn't a lot of real discussion of how they were going to make all this work downtown. And the decision about the auto lane was pretty well a given, and that's the real.
So I'm going to say a couple of things that maybe you may not agree with, but I think it's important. There has been in recent years a kowtowing to a short-termer thinking, and I say this directly because it's true, on the part of the Portland Business Alliance, which is the merger, essentially, of a more conservative or even reactionary business community together with the Chambers of Commerce. I'm going to say that directly, and I think this is what's influencing a lot of the decision-making right now downtown. That's number one. Number two, I believe that the transit agency, and this is not the first time, is so anxious to get the money to build these things that they will do anything, and I mean anything, to get the thing built. They're not thinking about the broader implications of it. They're not thinking about the larger planning issues. They're not thinking of the aesthetics. They're not thinking even of the long-term business impact of what they build. They want to get that money because it's only these small windows of opportunity out of the federal system, and they've got to get a design up and running. Now, I got to tell people that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM. It's talk radio with me, Joe Uris, and Abe Proctor. The number to call is 231-8187. Our guest is Ron Buell. We're talking about the Transit Mall downtown, and I think we have some callers. In fact, we have a lot of callers. Who do we have first? Annie, you're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and I have a couple of three things.
Can you turn off your radio, because I think you're echoing or something?
Oh, I think it's because of where I am. I'm in a room by myself.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm on a cell phone. I'm not driving.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Anyway, I'm with you, Joe. I think that, you know, for the past several years, we have just lacked common sense in this country, maybe all over the world. You know, you talk about the short term. And it would seem to me that oftentimes I wonder if the people who make these grand plans are people who really don't use the system personally. They just think it's grand for someone else to use. And it would seem also that wouldn't it make more sense to educate the people as to birth control and population control rather than waiting to kill them on the mall. And my last thing is for Mr. Buell is how do I find this visa business for the disenfranchised.
Ah, she wants one of your credit cards.
Yes.
Debit card. Debit card.
Not a credit card. I don't want a credit card, and I don't want to have to fool too much with those damn banks, you know.
Well, I'll give you my business number, 503-292-5033. But
5033?
Yeah. But, you know, I think you make some good points. And I want to just mention about community, because we really are losing it. And that's a result of a lot of this short-term. And part of the thing that our public agencies need to do is to think about designs that build community. And George Crandall made this point in his presentation last night at the Downtown Neighborhood Association.
Which was packed, by the way.
Yeah, it was a lot of people there, and they were all pretty much in agreement with what George had to say. And he pointed out how TriMet started building the interstate line on I-5 instead of on Interstate Boulevard, and how they wanted a certain design, and the merchants and the banks who were going to invest in the merchants in that corridor came to City Hall and said, no, we want this to work for the neighborhoods and the businesses, this transit. And then he pointed out what's happened in Hillsborough, where they took the parking off the street that the transit is on, and all the retail is pretty much dead on that street through downtown Hillsborough. And that shouldn't be the outcome of putting transit, a nice transit system like our light rail, into a place like Hillsborough. So, you know, the point is we've got to be more sensitive to the decisions we make, and the transportation planners need to think about, in the way that Jane Jacobs thinks, in the way that she talks about how urban spaces really work, and the difference between creating a dead space like a freeway and having a neighborhood where people can walk to and from their home and their other experiences outside their home.
Okay, I want to invite some of our callers. I know they're starting to back up here. 231-8187. Let's go out to George.
Hello.
Hi.
From what I understand about the design of the thing, there's going to be an island in the middle of the street, and
no island.
No island?
No island.
That was one of the final designs, was the island design, and they reject it for the serpentine weave.
The island system, by the way, used to be the red car approach in downtown Hollywood and downtown Los Angeles, when they had the great red car surface interurban transportation system. And a lot of cities used to have those, but this plan does not include islands at this time.
Okay, and are they going to chop down the trees?
Yeah, there are going to be a bunch of trees that come off the mall. Yes, there will be a bunch of trees that come off the mall.
So the beauty of the mall is going to be really marred.
Well, I'm not sure what it's going to look like when it's done. I don't know if you like those mushroom stalls now, and I have not seen the drawings that have been done of the new stops.
Okay, well, no islands, huh? Okay.
No
well,
island.
Thank you.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call, George.
So we're looking at three lanes, one reserved exclusively for cars and two shared by the train and the bus.
That's correct.
And the car lane, you're telling us, is essentially a stop that's been thrown to businesses on the mall.
Without much meaning, since
right.
There's no parking.
Yeah, because even there's no car access to those businesses.
And people can't even, it would be dangerous for somebody to get out of the car.
Even now, there's none or limited car access or parking
well,
for cars.
Well, you can drive around the block, which is good.
Right.
But it doesn't do much for the businesses. That's why you have, I did my own little personal survey of the mall, and there are eight four lease spaces on the transit mall right now between Madison and Burnside.
All right, 231-8187, Talk Radio, Abe and Joe, KBOO 90.7. Our guest, Ron Buell, talking about the transit mall plans downtown. And how the citizen input process has been, I'm going to say, perverted. We have invited TriMet to call. I don't know if they, you left him a message, right?
I did.
And you tried to reach him. I mean,
I did.
And they haven't responded.
They have not.
Okay, let's go to one of our callers. Gordon, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
This is another example of fleecing the taxpayers' monies. Here's an example of taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich. I mean, this is a prime example. This whole freeway traffic thing that Bush has going on, and this whole, it's all about taking money from the Treasury and lining the hands of the rich corporate people that are actually doing the work, which is worthless. What about the people in the southeast side of town? How about the people in Oregon City that can't get to town because they have the bus system, but everybody on the rich side of town, Lake Oswego, Beaverton, Hillsboro, they all have Macs.
Well, but to be fair, Gresham and so on also have a Max line, and that's a pretty working class area.
Well, I don't know. Have you watched where Max goes up Burnside? I mean, they're all pretty nice houses all the way up there. I mean, it suits the business. It suits the business to get those people on that side. But really,
well, I think the main function that Max serves in all three existing lines. It really, or four if you count the airport, is about planning. That is about bringing a transportation system to areas that need or are desired to be developed. I really don't see it as a class issue. I mean, I ride the Max, and it looks pretty working class to me.
That's what I see when I'm on the train. A lot of people who need the transit service.
Right, but the rich are benefiting from that by getting those people in there at low wages, and that won't give them raises, won't give them health coverage. It's another way to capitalize on this whole system. But above and beyond that, we have people on the southeast side that have no transit, but it seems like all the Maxes on the west side are going out to the rich people, and there's nothing coming out past there's nothing even because of the Clackamas Town Center. The planning, it's ridiculous. But I like the topic. Thanks for you guys having this. TriMet, I saw, didn't lower their prices when the prices of the oil went down. They still haven't lowered their prices for fares.
And, well, no. Anyway, I appreciate your call, but I want to, just in defense of TriMet, I think that the light rail has really helped the city. I think it's taken a lot of cars off the road. I think the same is true for the bus system. I think that the problems that I'm addressing here, and that Ron is addressing, and I think Abe agrees, are not about the idea of the light rail, although I would like to see a subway downtown, but not about the idea of light rail, or even the ultimately difficult question of routing. I think the problem is that when they decide to do these projects, they rush them to get done. They don't use the best minds to develop the specifics of them.
And they do it stupidly.
And I look at the the disappointing numbers, apparently, on the north-south route going out to the north end. There's a lot of problems.
And that line needs to go to Vancouver. But
yes, it does.
But the west side light rail has been hugely successful.
Oh, it grows 8% a year, I think.
And the line coming in from Gresham is doing very, very well. I mean, it's packed a lot of the time.
In fact, this goes again to the problem of how long the damn trains can be and how close together they can run. And that brings up, of course, the subway issue. If you could go underground in downtown, you could have four car trains or longer, and you'd have more carrying capacity. The problem is that these short blocks downtown on the surface require these no longer than two car trains.
Yeah, the split that we need, if those of us who are worried about the economics of the society, you have to be worried about the automobile versus transit, because there are a lot of elderly people and a lot of poor people and a lot of young people who need to get around. And they can't drive. They can't own an automobile. And transit is the people's way of going. And the bus system in this city is very, very important to a lot of people who don't have much dough. And so we've got to continue to improve and have a system that works for everybody. And, you know, the oil companies and the Automobile Dealers Association, they may not feel exactly the same as we feel about this. But we've got to defend transit and make it work better, and that's what this is really about. It's not about trying to tear down TriMet or trying to tear down transit in general.
I think Gordon hit on a very important point, though, and that is that it seems like time and time again these big-dollar projects go to the wrong ends. I mean, we don't need to revamp the bus mall. Granted, the bus mall has its problems, but it essentially functions.
Why not instead run streetcars up Broadway, up MLK, up Hawthorne, up Powell? Why not run a MAX spur down 99E to Milwaukee? I mean, they've expanded the streetcar line once since they've put in the first line. And where does that go? To River Place. And where are they sending the next expansion? To Lake Oswego. Those are the communities that don't need these things as much as the places I just mentioned.
Well, and I think there's a lot of issues here. For example, Seattle has, and Vancouver, B.C. has, trolley buses, which are a very clever adaptation of electric transportation. We do not have that. We had that at one time, by the way, in the city, and they took them all out. The argument against them is that the wires are expensive and unsightly, but the fact of the matter is building those kinds of lines, like up Sandy, up Broadway, and so on, is much cheaper than building light rail or even building trolley systems.
You're talking about the double-long buses with the accordion thing in the middle?
No, I'm not. That's a possibility, but I'm talking about a bus that essentially it gets its power from an
right,
overhead
from the
electric.
Overhead line. Yeah.
Yeah. And they run, they can weave in and out because they're only connected at the top.
They're buses.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Hey, we got a lot of callers. 231-8187. Again, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. A Proctor, Joe Uris, Ron Buell is our guest. We're talking about the transit mall plan downtown and some of the potentially disastrous aspects of that plan. We do want to hear from you. We're going to take a call from Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I agree completely with the criticisms of Abe and Joe. The Tribune described this revitalization project as a ballet between the buses and the light rail. I think with the same logic, you could describe the Iraq War as a symphony.
Yeah, well, this is a dance of hippos or something.
Instead of a tram or this absurd revitalization project, people should be given a discounted ticket to Vancouver, Canada, to a real city, to a port city, and witness this computer-operated light rail that they have. No conductor. It's a light rail that goes from Science World to New Westminster across the whole city, and it has functioned without accident since 1986, and it runs every 5 minutes. There's a lot we could learn if we just say farewell to our pride. You know, there's a lot we could learn from Vancouver and from Canada, and this, I think, is this project to me is an anti-homeless project, project just to disrupt Fifth and Sixth for two years, and a monument to short-term fixation.
Well, thank you for your points. I do want to say that I'm still an advocate for farther, longer-term thinking. I think elevated-type lines like the BC line you're describing in Vancouver, but probably, and realistically for Portland, a subway downtown, which you have to bite the bullet. It's very expensive initially, but the long-term advantages are horrendous. Wonderful, I should say. I just think that's something that they should have done when they started this whole light rail thing, and they essentially rejected it. That time it would have been half a billion dollars. Now it's $1 billion.
Have you ever been to Tokyo and spent much time in Tokyo, Mark?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's got an amazing modal split in which the people who are riding on rail and transit far outweigh the number of drivers in that city, and it is got 20 million people in a very dense area, and it works remarkably well for getting around on rail, in a subway, on the ground, and all grade separated,
and fast trains and light rail and everything.
The whole nine yards.
Vancouver is a very dense city, and the mosaic functions beautifully. People actually listen and respect one another. I was very depressed when I saw this headline in the Vancouver Sun about building their way out of congestion, a new $3 billion idea of building new roads and bridges, which is just the wrong way, you know?
Every city faces the challenge of the enormous pressures of the petroleum industry, the automobile industry, and so on.
But changing our consciousness, yearning for simple alternative lifestyles and sharing work should be priorities, I think.
I agree, and thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
The Iraq War Symphony, that was pretty funny.
Dancing hippos isn't bad.
Symphony in one long movement.
Oh, man. All right, we got a lot of callers. 231-8187. I wanted to give you an opportunity to inject some more other stuff for a moment.
We can save that for the end.
Okay, we'll
get this. We're rolling here.
Yeah, Ron Neal's good. I have been a long-term supporter of the trolley and the light rail and the bus system, and I really think TriMet is, in overall, a great agency. But I have run into these kinds of problems before. During the period of time when they were going to build that, they were going to shove through, I think, the light rail through Milwaukee and so on, and suddenly there was this enormous community activism against the particular route they chose. They rigidly insisted on it, and they actually lost a vote. And the same thing happened in Washington State. And I think that TriMet is unresponsive and arrogant, and I think it's driven by the desire, which is understandable, to get the money while it's available and build whatever. And I think that this is a disastrous kind of thing. I further think the TriMet's cutting down on bus service because it can justify it by saying, well, we now have light rail, makes no real sense.
Yeah, they've cut operating service in the last six quarters for budget reasons, and that I'm worried that what's going to happen here is that during this two-year period when the buses are running in auto traffic, largely on 3rd and 4th, but maybe on Columbia and Jefferson and 10th and 11th as well, that operating costs are going to continue to go up, and they're going to continue to cut the bus service. And we've already talked about the fact that that would not be good.
Okay, we got some callers. Let's go out to 231-8187. Let's go out to another Gordon.
Hi.
Hi, other Gordon.
I would just like to tell you that I was on TPAC, which is, you know, the bureaucrats plus six citizens.
Uh-huh.
And when this originally came up, I raised some questions. This would be in the early 90s. And I went to the guy who was the staff person, that's Andy Catugno.
At Metro, yes.
And who's really Mr. Transportation in the region, one of the brightest guys I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I raised some concerns to him privately, and he looked at me and privately said, you know, Gordon, this is already decided.
You mean it was a done deal then?
And that's 15 years ago. There was not one single public hearing at the time. There was no impact statements.
When was this? What year?
Oh, I would say about 92, 93. This is before, you remember when Bill Nadeau, who had a lot of clout in this town, raised a lot of these same concerns. He was ignored. So, you know, there's a power structure in this town, and what they decide for whatever reason, and it really has to do with the real estate in downtown Portland and whether they can continue to resell for higher and higher. And they don't care about whether it really works. By the way, TriMet was set up and designed to get federal grants. And they went out and they hired the first guy who knew how to get federal grants. This is what they've always been about. Nothing has changed. And I'm sorry to report this, but it was the greatest political lesson I ever had, because I've just watched this ever since, and it's awful. And what they're going to do is eventually kill downtown.
Well, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate the insights that you add from your experience with the so-called citizen input. I'm sorry for your cynicism, and I appreciate the problems. I want to add a couple of things. I want to thank the Portland Tribune. You know, here's a newspaper that is comes out twice a week, struggles, but it reports local news that is totally ignored by, I'm afraid, by Willamette Week, by the Oregonian. I looked today at the Oregonian after your big meeting yesterday, I mean, packed meeting at City Hall. There was not one, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see it, not one article in the Oregonian talking about the issues that you guys had raised in your big meeting yesterday, Ron Buell. So, on the other hand, the Tribune, Nick Burdick and Jim Redden do an incredible job of reporting on this. as a front page story. And I think that bless the Tribune, even though it is run by a Christian conservative.
Well, Mr. Budnick, you know, was at Willamette Week, and he's done a good job, and so has Jim Redden, not just on this piece, but on bringing things to light locally and in the public life. And so, you know, congrats to those guys for hanging in there and doing a good job.
Well, I hope the Tribune survives. It's a difficult newspaper world.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and the advertising.
I don't need to tell you that.
It's not as hard as it was during the early '80s, Joe.
Really, I just want to remind people that Ron Buell was the guy who created really Willamette Week, and I had the honor of working for him as a reporter in those halcyon days. Salad days, anyway, and that in those days the paper was actually a full size, full sheet paper, I think we did a lot of expose journalism, top notch stuff. If I do say so myself.
Well, it's interesting looking back on it. You know, my time before that was with Neil Goldschmidt, and
we don't mention his name.
You don't mention his name
anymore.
Well,
a week does.
Because
he
was in hotel rooms with a 14-year-old.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Okay, I
did not have
to
any
ask.
Contemporaneous knowledge of statutory rape within the statute of limitations.
Okay.
But,
all right.
But
a lot of our listeners are not laughing. But anyway,
well, the point is that the city and TriMet and the state, for that matter, worked a lot differently back in the 70s, Joe.
Yeah.
Than it does today, and a lot was accomplished by the now frowned upon Goldschmidt administration. And we're talking about Pioneer Square and Tom McCall Waterfront Park and stopping an actual freeway or two,
mm-hmm.
I-405 and the Mount Hood Freeway, and things that were said to be a done deal, like this is said to be a done deal.
Do you think you can stop this process, or at least make
it's going to be interesting to see what the Sam Adams and the City Commission does. I think it's not. I don't want to stop the project. I want them to redesign what
and
they're
going
to do on the mall and make it right. I think that it's not a lot of very big changes.
I don't know.
The
they're going to build the flying bus despite all the other nonsense. Let's go to some of our callers. 231-8187. Scott, if you're still there, you're on the air.
I am. Hi, Joe and Ed.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hey, I wanted to kind of broaden out the issue, which may be related, but maybe a long-term goal. TriMet board is not.
And I think that if we would have had voter-owned elections 5 years ago, we'd see a whole different process for what's going on the transit mall down there.
We agree with you.
The business people claim that they're not being profitable downtown because there's no cars on the mall. Well, I'm in business with somebody that used to have a profitable business on the bus mall, and she never found lack of autos to be any detriment to her business. She did really good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people don't want to look at the global economy, and they don't want to look at these other factors. And when we talk about economy, the city is not planning for the post-petroleum economy. And I spent 2 years a little while back working with the Citizens Working Group for some planning out here in North Portland. And when I asked the people from PDOT if they were planning for the post-petroleum economy, and the people from the Planning Bureau, I just got these blank stares. No. Well, gas is going to be going through the roof. Don't you think that'd be a good idea? And the reason I bring this up is there's, you know, a couple things. Putting cars in, any time a car interfaces with the MAX trains, so a few little points it does, it's always a big mess. And so now they're going to create a bigger mess down there. And that's, you know, I think there's Scott had a good point about the electoral process, and it is the governor that does appoint the TriMet board, and we do have some.
We need a governor, actually.
Yeah, well,
one of
there's
the things
a guy
we
named
need.
Pete Sorensen. He's running for governor, and he's got some good ideas.
Okay,
but they can find him at PeteSorensen.com, and actually, he beats Ron Saxton and he beats Kevin Mannix in the head-to-head poll. So all these labor unions go to Kulongowski so he can stab him in the wife. It's the old battered, stab him in the wife. I'm sorry.
Maybe I've got my Pete Sorensen.
Wife, stab him in the back. It's battered wife syndrome, you know, here.
I've got my Pete Sorensen bumper sticker on my car, and I think Pete's got some really good ideas.
Yeah, he is about bringing democracy back to the people and listening to things.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
You know what?
What?
When I used to go quail hunting, we always knew where everybody was. You
well, that's a rule.
You never walk off and leave people behind.
Yeah, I used to hunt boys, and I can tell you that everybody's behind everybody else. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean. Anyway, okay, that's a great segue. Thanks a lot, Paul. Let's talk for a minute, if you don't mind, Ron. We have been talking about the Transit Mall, but let's talk about quail hunting.
And we're going to have Ron hang around in case you have any more questions.
Yeah, about the Transit Mall downtown. But, you know, I think quail are kind of cute.
Except when they're a part of the Republican ticket. Not so cute anymore.
Okay.
Anyway. Hey, Cheney shot a guy. I just love saying that. So I may say it a few more times.
But he shot a lot of people. He's the president of the United States, you know, Cheney.
That's true. He is.
Yeah.
Cheney was hunting on Saturday in Texas.
Yeah.
For quail.
He was hunting for quail. You know, they're dangerous. They're a dangerous bird. They can crap right on your head.
Right. And the long and short of it is he shot a 78-year-old hunting companion.
Slow. He was a slow man.
Yeah.
He's a lawyer from Austin who was well-connected, who actually helped the Bush family's friends, you know. This is true. Yeah.
They're hunting on the ranch of somebody named Catherine Armstrong, who is a Bush-Cheney pioneer, meaning one of their top fundraisers.
Well, yeah.
So the initial report that came out, there's a lot of conflicting information and a lot of
24 hours to get this
questions.
Out there.
Yeah, the White House, apparently the vice president shot somebody and the White House didn't think it was newsworthy.
Well, the first thing that Cheney did after he rushed to the aid of the guy was to call Rove.
To call Rove, yes.
Call Rove.
And Rove.
Rove, what should I do? I shot somebody!
Rove, in turn, got on the phone with Catherine Armstrong, the owner of the ranch, before she talked to the press. And she was, of course, the first person to come forward
well, but,
and talk
well,
to
where
press.
Did she break the story?
In a local paper.
Online.
Online?
Well, yeah,
see that, I didn't
not
know.
Even in print. Online. They tried to bury the sucker.
Yeah, they did try to bury the sucker. But, of course, when the vice president shoots somebody, it's you know it's kind of hard to cover up. Now, what about his victim? This victim is reportedly in stable condition. We don't know a whole lot.
He got a lot of birdshot
all
over
him. Yeah, he got peppered with birdshot.
One side of his body, his face, his neck. His arm?
Right.
That hurts, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of birdshot in one of them shots.
The initial print report, of course, the only source that the local reporters had to talk to was this woman, Catherine Armstrong.
Yeah.
Who basically downplayed the whole event.
It was an accident.
Oh, by God, he got peppered. Yes, he did.
It's a hunting accident. You guys are trying to make it sinister. It's just a damn hunting accident.
Well, I went on to read a little bit about shotgun wounds.
Shotgun
wounds. Even peppering hunting accidents, which is the most common shotgun wound,
yeah.
You're looking at a great deal of time on the operating table to remove all of these pellets.
Well, there's a lot of maceration of the flesh.
There is indeed. And any reconstruction that has to go on is an extremely painstaking and time-consuming and difficult.
But if you're 78, what the hell?
Right. So we've got a victim in stable condition, whatever that means. We've got a vice president who has yet to speak to the press. We've got...
It's an accident!
Right. The only official pronouncements have been from from Scotty McClellan in the White House newsroom, and as usual, his reports are full of contradictions. And the whole thing stinks, frankly.
Well, you're not saying it wasn't an accident. You're not saying they tried to kill the guy.
Well, here's... No, he didn't try to kill the guy.
Okay.
But generally, when there's a hunting accident, when you accidentally shoot somebody... The right thing to do is to step forward and take responsibility.
Well, he rushed to the man's side.
We haven't
Cheney
heard a
did.
Damn
well,
thing.
Well, he limped to his side. But listen how fortunate it is, because Cheney has doctors in constant attendance because his heart might fail. They had doctors right on the scene.
Yeah, well, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, sorry.
So the initial report from this woman, Armstrong, was that, well, this guy, the 78-year-old companion, just happened to be in the wrong place, and he was where Cheney didn't expect him to be.
Well, but let's be fair. The guy had broken away from the group, and he had come up on the hunting site without announcing his presence. This is their story. And it's very easy. I know this. It's very easy when you're following or actually leading a bird with your shotgun. You know, you shoot a little ahead of the bird. To something gets in your way, like a person. It's easy to have that happen. Hunting accidents are real common in America.
Yes, they are.
They are.
But what is the National Rifle Association's number one gun safety rule? Make sure the barrel of your gun is pointed in a safe direction.
Well, duh.
And I went over these rules.
Yeah.
And by any interpretation, the vice president is at fault. The initial news report made this guy out to be at fault. But ultimately, the person who pulls the trigger is at fault if he shoots somebody.
Oh,
and that's what happened.
You know, guns don't kill people. No, wait a minute. That's wrong. I got it back.
Yeah, vice presidents with shotguns shoot people on hunting trips. Now, there's a number of other funky things that happened here. Local law enforcement authorities went to this ranch to talk to Cheney.
Yeah,
but they were turned away.
You have to.
They were turned away by his Secret Service detail.
You're kidding.
Yeah, Cheney's not in Texas anymore, and so far he hasn't talked to law enforcement.
No, that can't
be true. Now, call me crazy, but usually when someone's hit by a firearm, they speak with law enforcement.
That's a tradition that we have upheld a long time.
Yes.
Even in Texas.
One of those quaint Democratic traditions we have in this country.
Small D.
Yeah, and the final icing on the cake here, in my opinion, is a quote from Mary Madeline, who's a high-level White House political advisor.
You know who she sleeps with? She sleeps with a high-level Democratic advisor.
James Carville, yeah.
Yeah, but never mind.
And they don't spontaneously combust. I don't know how that – well, maybe they do. All right, this is what Madeline said. He felt badly, obviously. On the other hand, he was not careless or incautious. He didn't do anything he wasn't supposed to do, with the exception, of course, of shooting somebody.
Well, mere bagatelle.
Mere bagatelle. Yeah, so we have yet to get a straight news report as to what happened here. Cheney has yet to go through the proper sequence of events.
Were they drinking?
Well, actually, local authorities have come to the conclusion, they said, that alcohol was not involved in the accident. Although how they came to that conclusion...
Since they didn't interview anybody.
Right, has yet to be revealed. So Cheney hasn't talked to the cops. The White House decided not to report...
Wait a minute, Cheney's the president of the United States. He doesn't have to talk to the cops.
I guess not. The other guy whom we call president wasn't informed apparently until the next day
that
his vice president shot somebody.
Yeah.
And, so far we really don't know what happened.
Rove was informed, and he's the real vice president.
Right, Rove was informed. We don't know what condition the victim is in.
He's in stable condition.
That can mean any number of things.
He's a bit macerated.
Yeah, he's actually the guy who got shot. So I imagine
78 years old. That
need to find out what's going on with him. So I think what happened here is the default position for the White House is to suppress information.
They put it on the net.
So this is what happened. This is what they did. They went immediately into lockdown mode. They didn't say anything. They didn't talk to the cops. That we couldn't get a straight answer out of Scott McClellan. And Cheney is incommunicado. So business as usual, except somebody got shot.
Cheney is a troglodyte. He has to be in a cave every day. You got to be fair about this. Okay, I got to tell people some really cool stuff that's coming up here on KBOO. And if you don't know it, you're listening to KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Talk Radio, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris, and our guest is Ron Buell. He's still sitting here, despite your rant against Cheney's murderous shotgunning. It wasn't murderous. Not yet. Transit Mall Plan is our main topic today. But guess what's going to happen at 9 o'clock on Between the Covers? Ed Goldberg's going to interview Greg Ruka, author of Private Wars, a spy novel set in Uzbekistan. Isn't that one of those places where they boil you alive? I think it is, yeah. At 9:30, only if you get remaindered. No, what is it called? What do you call it when you take an American prisoner and put him in Uzbekistan and dip them in hot...
Rendered.
Rendered. You get him rendered. Yeah, they render the fat right out of him. And then at 9:30, a group of local film buffs will help you decide which films to see at the more than 75 offerings at the Portland International Film Festival, which is a cool event. And at 10:30, also the African Film Festival, another cool event. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, D. May Roberts has Valentine's Day special. We didn't do Valentine's Day at all today.
No.
We totally blew it off. And at 11, Democracy Now!, my favorite show, spends the hour with Shlomo Ben-Ami, author of Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, and Norman Finkelstein, or Steen, author of Beyond Chutzpah. They'll talk about the origins of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, the Oslo peace process, and the present situation. You know, we actually have to do our Palestine-Israel show sometime in the near future. We have to bite the bullet and talk about that history. Because a lot of people don't.
Oh, yeah. I think
we should do that.
That's fascinating.
Also, KBOO reporter Richard Francis recorded the TriMet meeting, the very one of which we're talking now. And he'll have a report on the KBOO News on Thursday. Also on Thursday, TriMet's 40-minute presentation on the Transit Mall will be posted to the KBOO website. What could be more fair? And I want to remind people, you should celebrate our multicultural community at KBOO. Special programming, a potluck-style open house on Saturday, February 18th. That's this Saturday. Tune in from noon to 9 for special programming on the air. Join us for the potluck open house from 1 to 6. Bring your food from your own cultural heritage. You know, that means if you're Hawaiian, you bring spam. Bring food from your own cultural heritage to share. That was... people are going to get me for that. To share with others as we celebrate this day together. Please... okay, and we have lots of callers. Again, we're focusing on the transit mall, but there's always Cheney's...
Cheney shot a guy.
Okay. 231-8187.
I got one more thing on this.
All right, go ahead.
All right, this is from Salon.com.
Salon.com.
Texas wildlife officials say that Vice President Dick Cheney was violating state law when he shot a 78-year-old attorney while hunting.
Wait. You mean shooting people against the law in Texas?
No, actually, that's not the law violation that they're talking about. Apparently, Cheney didn't have his proper stamp. From the Parks and Wildlife
Department. He's the president. He doesn't need a stamp.
He didn't have his hunting license. That's what it boils down to. Yeah. You need what's called an upland game bird stamp from the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. It costs $7. And you need it before you set off in search of, quote, turkey, quail, pheasant, chachalaca, and lesser prairie chicken.
Quail are cute.
What's a chachalaca?
A chachalaca is what we call a chucka.
Right. Right. So he shot a guy, which in most civilized places is a violation of the law, and he didn't have a hunting license when he did it.
But he's the president.
Yeah.
You know, Bush is the hood ornament of this administration.
Right.
Anyway, did you want to say something, Ron? You look.
Yeah, I was thinking about what Paul had to say about clean money and clean money.
Yeah.
And elections in this city. And we had a mayor who got elected because he wouldn't take more than $50 or $100 for his campaign and basically ran on that. And mm-hmm. and now we have Eric Sten who tried to get a public utility up for re-election. And Eric pushed through the city council this clean money ordinance that allows people to run for city commission by collecting a bunch of signatures, and they get their campaign funded, so that we can have they don't have to go out and ask a bunch of businesses for money, which is basically what's always happened in the past 30 years. And so the Portland Business Alliance who is behind the lane on the transit mall that we're talking about.
The car lane.
Is in fact the same group that is trying and involved in trying to overturn the public funding of elections that the city council passed, and they're out collecting signatures. Now we don't know if they got enough. And here this, in the next week or so, we'll find out. But if they
there was a little scandal about that, I think.
Well, kind of. But the point is that these folks are used to running stuff, and if we really have a publicly funded election system, which I support, they're going to lose some clout and things like public power may actually hold sway in Portland. And so they're concerned, and they've got a candidate in this Jenny Burdick who's running against Eric Sten, and they've got this initiative trying to overturn the clean money. And I think we're seeing examples of how Portland politics works, and I think Paul was very observant to point this out to us, your labor reporter, your guy.
Paul is generally right. Correct. Not right, but correct.
Right.
And we have a lot of great callers, people with a lot of good insights. And maybe there's even one of them surviving now. Who we got?
Barbara, good morning. Cheney shot a guy.
Barbara, Hello. Are you there?
Barbara?
Barbara's not there. Next caller. Who's the next caller? We're going to go on. None. We drove them all away. Incredible. Boy.
Yeah.
Cheney shot a guy. Is that your point? That's your point?
That's my point.
Cheney shot a guy, and he's responsible for a lot of people dying, dude.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I know that.
You know. You probably know that.
And he's responsible for fattening Halliburton shareholders.
Boy, does he! And he still holds the Halliburton stock, you know?
Yeah, he does. And he still receives deferred compensation from them every year.
Oh, I'm sure that it's perfectly legitimate.
Coincidence.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that happens. And besides which, he's the president.
Right.
And the real president, well, the figurehead president, still has that look like he's in the headlights. You know, he might be mistaken for a deer by Cheney with the headlights thing.
Who would shoot him without the proper license?
Right? You said that. 231-8187. With us is Ron Buell talking about the Transit Mall and actually enlarging the conversation to the question of how you finance elections. And, in fact, how do you restore, and I say restore because I mean this, democracy to a city government that has, for most of its history, been in the hands of a certain good old boy network, or several good old boy networks. In fact, I think the only competitions we've had, except for some brief insurgencies like the recent mayor's election, basically one good old boy network against another.
It seems like that's the way things are, and how much money you can raise from people who have a stake in what happens has been the deciding factor up until very recently, and we could in fact return to that situation very easily, and that's why I think it's important to call attention to this initiative that people are trying to get on the ballot.
Well, you know, one of the problems is that people will sign a petition without understanding its implications, and often I ask people, why'd you sign that? And they say, well, everyone should have a chance to vote on it. I don't think people get the idea of representative democracy, and I don't think they get the idea that their signature actually is a vote being cast for the thing they're signing the petition on. They don't really understand. They think they're going to have an airing of the issue. They're not really getting it, and I think that's kind of a shame. And of course, the signature gatherers, we've seen time after time, even though changes in the law and so on, we've seen time after time that they essentially are just in it for the money. Anyway, we got a lot of calls, finally, back. 231-8187. Let's go out to Jay. Hi, Jay.
Jay, hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello. I've been in Oakland, Portland for less than a year.
Uh-huh.
And it's very evident to me that the Portland, is it called the Portland Businessmen's Association?
Portland Business Alliance.
Alliance, yeah. It's very clear to me that they run this town.
No.
Well, yeah. And most of the complaints that I've heard from the citizens, somehow they always rate, like, what do they call it, where they prevent people from being in a certain area.
Oh, like, what's it called? The exclusion ordinance.
Right. And then the way the parks, as I understand, Portland's trying to make the downtown area more more holistic and more ecologically sound, and they interfere with that, and so now this thing about the new transit thing, which I don't fully understand, and I probably my ignorance will be evident when I ask this question, but I'm very serious about it, and that is, why aren't the private automobiles prevented from being in this this problem area? Why isn't there an outlying area where people can come in, park their cars, and then board small, fast-moving vehicles that would get them here even more efficiently than the automobiles, and then there wouldn't be these parks? Why have private cars on a street where you can't park, and besides, why have them there anyway?
Hmm. Good. No, those are really good questions, man. I don't think they're either naive or inappropriate. Valid questions.
Would you all please take opposing positions and explain why this isn't the case?
I'm not sure we could take an opposing position, but I'll let Ron Buell respond to you. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right that we do need to have system that you describe in some degree, and we do have it in some degree. We've got a pretty good transit system, but putting autos on the mall when they can't park on the mall doesn't do what people want to have happen.
But you can see the stores as you cruise by.
Well, I know, but you can't stop.
No.
And being able to drive around the block has some value. We have to admit, you know, people are looking for a parking place, or they're they're waiting for some a loved one to come out, and so you know we understand why people want to have cars on the mall, but in this case it's really fouling things up.
No, and I think that I can't speak for everyone, but I think that people are more and more and should in fact be using the buses and the light rail and the trolley and park in the outlying areas, and there should be more parking for those people actually.
No, a number of European cities and some big ones too, I guess, have auto-free central areas.
Yeah.
But I think that's a pretty tough sell in this country.
Yeah, you have about, you know, if you look at the total number of trips, we're running 90% auto trips in compared to transit.
And, really?
Yeah, in the region, that's pretty high. Not downtown, obviously, but in the region.
All right, we got time for at least one quick call. Liz, you're on the air.
Good morning, Liz.
Hey, good morning. This is a great show this morning.
Thank you.
I was involved in the PUD elections, and, you know, one thing that always sort of confounded me was, you know, business interests, usually the bottom line is the bottom line. But in the case of public power, something else seemed to intervene there. Businesses were not putting the bottom line first. We know with public power that rates would have been lower, especially for industrial customers and even just commercial businessmen. But somehow something else intervenes there.
It's called ideology.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's a carefully constructed myth in this country that the private sector always runs and administers businesses more efficiently than the public sector, and it's simply not true. And I think that a very successful campaign was waged against the public power system on these grounds, that it would be yet another inefficient, high-cost government bureaucratic boondoggle.
See, Americans are always taught it's kind of it's sort of the automatic position. They're always taught that everything that goes wrong has to do with government. Everything that goes right has to do with private enterprise. This is shown time and time again to be overgeneralization and generally not true. And you know what? We've run out of time. I want to thank the people at Portland Tribune and Ron Buell. I want to thank you for coming in. It was a great show. Transit Mall, look into it. You might get a little nauseous, but it's necessary. You got to stop foolishness wherever you find it.
Cheney shot a guy.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
Portland International Film Festival is on again, and as usual, there are way too many films to choose from. But don't worry, KBOO is here to help. On Tuesday morning, we'll present a program of reviews of films in the festival. That's 9:30 Tuesday morning for the Portland International Film Festival.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up on this morning's Radio Zine, First, on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Greg Rucka, author of Private Wars, a spy novel set in Uzbekistan. At 9:30, a group of local film buffs will help you decide which films to see of the more than 75 offerings in the Portland International Film Festival. And at 10:30 on Stage and Studio, D'Mae Roberts has a Valentine's Day special. And at 11, Democracy Now! Spends the hour with Shlomo Ben-Ami, author of Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, and Norman Finkelstein, author of Beyond Chutzpah. They'll talk about the origins of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Oslo peace process, and the present situation. Now let's go to Between the Covers.